why not try this kid?
Yeah, no, definitely. At risk of backtracking ever so slightly, just because I think it's just a very interesting story to share with the viewers, that actually just before he becomes Prime Minister, when he's sort of in his wilderness years before the India Act gets passed, he actually does leave the country for the one and only time in his life. This is when his trip to France is. And I'll be very brief about it, but he goes with two of his friends from Cambridge. He goes with William Wilberforce and with Edward Elliot. Apparently he had a penchant for the illiterate names, you know, as his friends. But they get to a Sitting Bourne, ready to cross the channel, and obviously to Dover. And they all sort of do that classic thing where, oh, and you've brought the travel papers, haven't you? No, I thought you were doing it. You know, and all three of them find that they haven't got their documents, their the letters of approval. So sort of the general idea was that if you're travelling to another country back then, you knew someone in that country who was going to vouch for your character, almost like a reference, you know, admit you were safe to go there. And they managed to get some of those documents from a friend for a gentleman living in Reims. And they get there and find that he's just a grocer and he's got one room in the back. And so they're all sort of huddled. You know, they've gone from Lincoln's Inn and all these great, you know, to just huddling in the back of this grocer's room for a few weeks. And then word spreads in France that the son of the great Chatham is about. And before you know it, he's invited to the great, you know, estates of Fontainebleau. And he actually does get to meet Louis XVI, Marie Antoinette, and he
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he very briefly meets the French aristocracy, which is very interesting because I think, obviously, as you know, students of history will know, those people aren't going to be around much longer. And so, you know, a bit like Burke, when Burke goes to France just sort of before and he says, well, I met all these people that you've just killed off and everything. So Pitt also got to do that. There was even talk of a proposal to marry Pitt to Jacques Necker, you know, the finance minister's daughter, which never happens. But eventually he's brought back on the urgent news of the India Bill being put through. So there we are. We've just caught up that little aspect of his life that's very interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. I knew Burke had gone across and met a lot of people. Mm. I didn't know Pitt had. That's surprising, because that's a fairly important detail.
It's the only time he goes abroad.
If he met Louis XVI. Mm. Yeah, okay, wow. Okay, that's interesting. Mm. It's always good to learn new things like that. Yeah, I have to slot that into my matrix of sort of knowledge about Pitt that happened. Try and remember that. That's a good one. So when he starts before, so there's a period there in his, in this sort of 17 year period of being Prime Minister. When he first gets in and then the events of the French Revolution. So I suppose that's sort of the calm before the storm, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. He's very diligent. He really enjoys finance. I can't fathom how. I think it's stuffy and dry, and I can only think of the Monty Python sketch with the chartered accountant who wants to be a lion tamer. But I think that he's very meticulous about the numbers. And at the time when he becomes Prime Minister, he obviously, as Chancellor of the Exchequer as well, he starts working on the budget. And but before that, he obviously needs to win the general election so he can crush this opposition. And so starts the mad, riotous general election of 1784. Right. And this results in all of the things that we'd spoken about, the public sentiment coming back onto his side. But another thing that Pitt does, which is very important and integral to how he acts as a statesman, is that we were obviously saying he's quite incorruptible and won't take a title for himself. But he just basically writes to the king and says, look, you need to unleash your power to create peerages. Mm-hmm. We need to get all the people who are opposing us get them sent to the Lords, you know, so I can do some more in the Commons, buy them off with peerages, you know, pay off this, his wife, she's got enormous debts. Can we have £2,000 there to pay that off so he'll come over
pensions
to my bench?
Pensions,
yeah. All these things, you know, the royal coffers are totally let loose, you know, because Pitt, although he's not interested in those things himself, he understands that that makes other men tick enormously, and he's willing to use those to do whatever he needs to shore up his own majority in the House of Commons.
One thing I think we have to say in that period before that election is that where he didn't have any sort of majority, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but Fox tabled a sort of vote of no confidence in him and won. And so, well, these days, if there's a vote of, if there's even really going to be a vote of no confidence, you're already, your government's certainly going to fall. If one actually takes place and you lose, you're absolutely obliged to resign and call another general election. If you don't, then quite legitimately people say, well, you're a tyrant then. And so that's what happened. Like that, so anyway, today it just wouldn't happen. But then Fox calls his vote of no confidence, wins it, and Pitt just refuses to resign. And it goes to the point where the king says, well, the bottom line legally is that the king can say, no, I'm not going to force you to resign, so I'm not going to. But so that's what happened, I believe.
Yeah.
But that is a constitutional crisis.
Yes, it is. But yeah, he's the king's last resort, you know, keeping Fox and...
I mean, I get why George III did that.
Right.
Because he's like, anything but Fox at any cost whatever.
Yes.
We'll have a civil war before I allow that to happen. I think, right?
I think he'd have done it. Yeah. But I suppose it's that thing as well that, you know, oh, we've tabled a vote of no confidence in you and we've won it. And Pitt's like, yeah, I know you have no confidence in me. Hmm. What do you think the past 2 months have been about? You know, with me not getting any legislation through. This is not new news, but that's okay. We're going to have the general election and I'm going to trounce you in it.
I just think that's crazily ballsy for Pitt. Again, as a young man, perhaps it was better that he was young, where you're sort of not scared sometimes when you're younger. I know it's the case. You get a bit more timid as you get older. That's why, you know, really old men... sometimes extremely scared, timid figures. And when you're young, really young, you're just ballsy.
He's not as confined by the conventions of his time.
Right. I mean, that is extremely brave to lose a vote of no confidence and go, yeah, what now? Mm. Yeah, I'm not going. What now? What are you going to do? Right, that's gutsy. It really, really is. Mm. Well, of course, he knew he had the king. It's gutsy of both of George III and Pitt to do that, because they could, or they very nearly were, or they were even staring down the barrel of, maybe you're going to get mobs now. Maybe there will be actual civil unrest, probably not on some sort of civil war, but okay, you're playing with fire now, very, very real politically. You're playing with fire now because your opponents legitimately can say you've got no right. They're not lying.
No.
There's a vote of no confidence in the Commons. What are you doing not resigning? So, again, not only is he young and a genius, but he's got sort of a will of iron.
Yeah, he does.
So he's a remarkable person.
Yeah. One anecdote to sort of demonstrate his appeal to the public. Forgive me, I can't quite remember chronologically where this slots in to the events, but I do think it is around the time of this election, is that he's being given the freedom of the city, of London, and he goes out to his carriage, and he's just swarmed by Pittites and followers from the general public who love what he's doing, and they uncouple the horses and start pulling his carriage for him. And obviously that's very flattering, but all of a sudden you've no idea where they're taking you. and they end up going around to Pall Mall, to the Prince Regent.
Oh, this is after he wins the election, that election.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think that's in the immediate wake of him winning the election, I think.
Right.
But sorry, go on. Yeah.
Oh, well, only to say that Pall Mall, where the Prince of Wales is living, and they start...
Carlton House.
Yeah, making some gestures and profanities at the... and they go around to Fox's residence, and Pitt has to stop them from smashing his windows. Just the untrammeled mob.
Mm.
Just, you know, you can't... it's only the respect for Pitt that actually gets him to obviously stop that happening. And then they pull round Brooks Club, which is where the big wigs literally hang out.
Yeah.
And a bunch of Foxites come out with clubs made of chair legs. And Pitt has to evacuate the carriage with his brother and be gotten to safety because these people are so outraged by him and what he's doing, and he eventually has to flee to the safety of White's club. But that's the level of, you know, riotous, just anarchy that these sorts of election processes could create at the time.
It's close to it. It was mob rule. It's very, very close to, if not really, the beginnings of some sort of mob rule. It's really interesting, that thing about the gentlemen's clubs, Brooks and White's. They still exist. White certainly does.
Mm.
Yeah, and the different political factions, lots and lots of gambling. Could go on and on and on about the gentlemen's clubs. So Pitt, very close to being beaten up, maybe beaten to death. Who knows? It could have got nasty real quick.
History could have changed that day.
So once again, to say, in comparison, we're very civilised in the 21st century compared to that, right?
We are.
I mean, you wouldn't get a mob surrounding Gordon Brown or Rishi Sunak trying to beat him up with chair legs.
No.
We would, you know, it's sort of crazy to think like that. Or sort of storming Downing Street and throwing bricks through Number 10's window.
Right.
So
no way.
It's a lot more cutthroat. It really is. Again, some of the paintings by Hogarth give you a feeling, sort of the general drunkenness. That's one thing I'd like to say. If you know, Pitt was something of a drunk, 3-bottle-a-day man. Fox was a drunk, not the first, not the last senior politicians who are essentially functioning alcoholics. But drink in general was extremely pervasive. I mean, most water was quite dirty, so even in the 19th century, a lot of people just drank small beer.
Yeah.
And you could buy a pint of gin for a penny.
Bargain.
There were just gin shops on every corner. Not every corner, that's an exaggeration, but you could get gin. You could get gin extremely easily in London in the late 18th century. Lots of it, really dirty, cheap gin. What, a penny? Of course, a penny was worth more than it is today, a lot more, but nonetheless. Pint of gin for a penny. So everyone, certainly by the evening, not everyone, but a lot of people were sort of drunk.
Yes.
A lot of the time.
Yeah.
When you look at the rum rations for the Royal Navy, sort of crazy, really. Sort of, was everyone walking around a little bit drunk most of the time? I think maybe. Again, today, the 21st century, we're actually a lot more, you know, people aren't drunk all the time.
No, we have grown up a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah, more raucous times. Much more raucous times.
I think the cherry on the top to this story as well, though, is that when they sort of put it to Fox, have you instigated this attack on Mr. Pitt? Fox's alibi was, no, it wasn't me. I was in bed with my mistress. Just as the absolute, you know, chef's kiss to finish that story. Then everyone was sort of like, oh, yeah, of course, yeah, fair enough, you know.
Oh, well, we can verify that, and it was the case, so...
Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
well done.
Yeah, for not instigating it, Mr. Fox.
But it's interesting you say that, but I think even though it was his alibi, he probably was a Foxite, some sort of... Well, they were the followers of Fox that did that.
They were.
I think the... just one last thing before we move on. I mentioned earlier the Gordon riots. I might be mistaken, but I think they're... sort of a bit before this, but just to say, just to give a colour of the times again on this topic of how sort of violent or tumultuous society was, politics was, the Golden Riots, so it's, I think that's 1780, anyway. You know, you've got, they did a run on the Bank of England. They tried to sort of burn down the Bank of England, or there was just a giant mob running amok, really, through London, burning down things, really pretty much completely out of control. Obviously nothing like the Sans-Culottes of Paris
no.
in 89 or whatever, but, you know, getting there, you are sort of quite close to mob rule or anarchy a lot of the time. Like, these days, it feels like we're nowhere near. Like, what would it take? I don't think there's any outrage that would make mobs like that take control of London or Paris, it seems.
Yeah, I think
whereas there,
that.
It's always like, it seems like it's one event away from happening. It's different times.
Yeah, definitely. There is a sense of morbid curiosity in the way of, well, what would it take in our times to create that sort of effect? But back then, yeah, much more volatile. And also, but, you know, it's just a sense you could get away with more. There's no CCTV. There's no fingerprints for what you're doing. You know, you're just a face in the crowd.
There's barely any police.
Yeah.
Until Robert Peel, much later, there's not really a proper police force as such. Mm. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And life is cheaper as well. I think people were, well, life was cheaper.
Mm.
So they're probably much more and shorter, brutal. People were more brutal.
Yeah, they were.
So, something Wilberforce talked a lot about manners, really morality. There was a lot more coarse in the 18th, early 19th century than it is today. But anyways, the beginning of Pitt's ministry.
With a majority.
Right, and now after this election, which
right.
he does
yeah.
do well, because the feeling in the country was people like Fox and his followers, yeah, they had their chance and mm-hmm. they screwed it up. They've been sort of at the top of power for a while now. We don't like what we're seeing.
No.
So let's try something new. And so he gets quite a big majority, doesn't he?
He does, huge. And this stays for a very, very long time. But even then, with a huge majority, that doesn't mean that all of his political endeavours actually come to fruition. He's defeated on a number of his sort of principal passion projects, actually. The first of which to mention is actually his pitch for reform, which you'd sort of briefly mentioned, you know, doesn't really come to fruition until 1832, you know, when it's passed with the Reform Act. But Pitt wants to sort of abolish all these rotten boroughs and just clear up the country a bit and, you know, rejig some of the lines of where, you know, these districts are and get some of the corruption out of politics. But even that, because again, it's that thing that what we were saying about, you know, just because you've been elected with people who are sympathetic to your government, there's no manifesto. They haven't promised to back you on this particular topic. You know, they're just sort of tepidly in your favour.
There's no whip system.
No, there's no whip system. And so that doesn't really go anywhere at all, really. But one of the big things that, you know, to start speaking of his achievements, you know, that start to happen as soon as he becomes PM, is, he writes his first budget. And at the time of that, obviously, Britain has I think it's £184 million of debt. That's what the national debt is. Obviously, a lot of that accumulated by the War of Independence. And the tax revenues generated per year at that point in England, are only sitting at 13 million. So you're not going to scratch the surface of starting to pay that off. And so what Pitt does, his economic plan, is to raise taxes, but in a way that is he thinks will be more palatable to the public by just putting little taxes everywhere as opposed to big taxes on a few things. And so there comes to be a tax on hats and bricks and tiles and linen and coal, although I think that one gets repealed. But he just taxes lots of little things. And another thing that he does to start stimulating the economy is to crack down on the smuggling trade that's going on around.
It's a big one.
Rampant at the time. I actually, when I was younger, one of my first ever residential trips, when I was a kid, about year six, so I'd have been 10 or 11, was to go to Robin Hood's Bay. Okay. On the Yorkshire coastline, which was one such place in the 1700s that was rampant for this this smuggling trade. And if you happen to be about, please go see it. It's a beautiful, it's like a moment frozen in time. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, very well preserved. But yeah, Robin Hood's Bay being an example of that. And they were smuggling in tea chiefly because the import tax on tea was at about 119%.
Mm.
And so Pitt brought that down to 25% so that people felt more sure about, you know, not looking to a legal means of acquiring tea, but going through the proper channels of commerce.
So yeah, quite often it's the case that if a tax rate is too high, if you bring it down, you actually get bigger incomes from it, big, larger revenues, because people are more likely to buy that commodity now.
Yeah.
So bigger volumes go through the books and you end up with more money as a net at the end of it. So that's something I'd just like to stress there for anyone who might not know that smuggling was a massive thing. Mm-hmm. In the 17th and 18th, even into the 19th century, there's lots and lots and lots of smugglers' bays all around the British coast. There's lots in Kent. There's lots all along the south coast and the east coast of Britain, all sorts of smugglers' coves, smugglers' bays. Instead of just paying the taxes on things, you just smuggle it in, sell it, illicitly, and the state, the government, gets nothing, and you keep it all. And it was just absolutely rampant. And that you can't really stress it enough how much that was. I don't know about crippling our economy, but we were just leaving loads of money. We were just losing essentially loads of money that we could have been, that the Exchequer could have been getting, that we weren't. And so where Pitt tightens up all sorts of things there, tea being the big one. But it was all sorts of things, wasn't it? Suddenly the revenues go way up.
Yeah.
And it becomes sort of a realistic possibility to pay off the national debt.
Yes.
It's that big.
Yeah. He consults with, he always, you know, finds, seems to have a knack for finding the right consultants on the particular issue. So on the thing with the tea smuggling, he consults Richard Twinings, now Twinings Tea. Mm. And, you know, they come up with a strategy of, well, we just expand the radius around Britain that our ships can seize the smuggling ships. We just say, no, now if you're in this radius. And so they manage to seize a lot of the smuggling ships. And that sort of, not necessarily absolutely cripples the smuggling industry, but certainly mitigates the worst of the damage.
Yeah. Yeah, now it goes on. I mean, well, it still goes on to this day, doesn't it? You smuggle in loads of cigarettes or whatever in your car, in your van.
Yeah.
Come back with a van load of duty-free. People smuggle things. They always will, probably. But yeah, he sort of breaks the back of it, where it was like an economy-damaging thing. Mm. He sort of reduces it hugely. And so where we've said near the beginning, he's sort of a details man. He's the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Yes.
He's sort of a micromanager on some level. There's nothing that his eye doesn't sort of take in. And he's able to really turn around the finances, which is, you know, that's the foundation. If you're going to do any big things, if you're going to have a big army or a big navy or giant building projects or just simply not have your country disintegrate, you need a firm foundation of economics.
You do.
And it's a particular type of person that's able to do that. You know, that's something Robert Walpole was great at, something Chatham was not ever interested in, let alone good at.
Yeah.
He didn't even try particularly. That wasn't really his game. But it is for Pitt the Younger, and he's good at it.
He is, but it's interesting to note as well, just as a point of one of his many contradictions, he's very, very fussy and careful about public spending and finances, but absolutely useless in his own personal finances, constantly ramping up debts, huge debts at the end of his life, just not on top of them. You know, there are, and another one of his things whilst he was in office was that he was just terrible for answering letters. Even after his death, you know, he had unopened letters from like 30 years before that he just never got round to opening or, you know, addressing. So, but, you know, because he just sort of always would answer them from the most important people, you know, invariably just someone probably just asking me for another peerage or whatever. So he just left a lot of them piled up, you know, carelessly at the side for much of his life.
It's interesting. He's not the only example of someone who's extremely good with figures and numbers and a great financier when it came to sort of state finances and terrible with their own personal debt. I did a conversation fairly recently with Benjamin Boyce about Alexander Hamilton, who's a great money man in all sorts of ways, set the stage for the United States to be a powerhouse of commerce and finance. And yet his own personal finances were a complete state. He was terrible with money himself in his own, with his own sort of personal bank account, so to speak. So yeah, Pitt was one of those, strangely. It was completely commonplace in the 18th and 19th century for great people, or not even those centuries, throughout a lot of history, if you're powerful and you come from sort of a landed rich family, to just perpetually live in debt, massive debt. Even the Prince Regent.
Oh, yes.
The king himself, the crown itself, bumbling along in giant debt. Pitt was no exception. You mentioned when he died, I think, didn't he have the equivalent of a couple of million pounds worth of debt or something?
About two million, I think.
In today's money.
Yeah, about...
Now that's...
£40,000 in his day.
That's
24, I think it was in his day.
Right.
24.
And adjusted today, it'd be a couple of million quid.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of madness, to me it is anyway. Like how, I wouldn't be able to sleep for the stress of it. Because if your debtors come a-knocking, suddenly you have to declare bankruptcy. And even in those days, it's not so much now, but in those days, if you were for some reason actually forced to formally, legally declare bankruptcy, that was a giant disgrace. Your political career may well be over. So if people want to try and ruin you that way, they can. It would just be a giant black cloud, a shadow hanging over you at all times. The stress of that. I mean, the stress in his life is a big part of his ultimate downfall. But we'll get to that.
So, sure.
So reform was one of the big things on his docket in his program for government.
Right.
What were some of the other
Ireland
biggest things? The Irish question
was
of
a
course.
big part of his policy question. Making. Yeah. And he was. There are two facets to Ireland that he tried to work on. One was the religious question, you know, of Catholic emancipation, which will certainly become a bigger topic later on. But the more immediate one was he diagnosed a lot of the problem as economic. And Pitt was very much influenced, as many people were back in the day, by The Wealth of Nations, by Adam Smith.
Right.
And he certainly believed in a lot of free market solutions to cure, to smooth out the edges, you know, and to alleviate poverty and to, you know, trust that the market will, you know, sort of work in the self-interest of most people. And so he wanted to basically create frictionless trade between Great Britain and Ireland. And this was very much contested by the English, by the British Parliament. But obviously the Irish had their own separate parliament at this point. So not only whenever it came to Ireland, Pitt didn't just have to get his proposals and his legislations through one House of Commons. He had to get it through two House of Commons because he had to find some sort of... compromise always that could work for both Britain and the Irish. and very, very rarely could you make that happen.
Hmm. Because, of course, deep into the 19th century, there was still the Irish question. That's what they would call it, you know, not
yeah.
trying to be deliberately provocative. That is what they would call it. Well, even into the late 20th century, you've got the Troubles.
Right.
And you could argue that it was only really brought to an end with the Good Friday Agreement under Tony Blair.
Sure.
And that it's all a continuation. Or you could say from sort of Henry II up to Tony Blair.
Right.
It's just an endless headache politically for both sides.
Yeah.
For both sides.
Yes.
So it was that was a big thing during Pitt's day, or at least during the first portion of his premiership. But he did do well, right? I suppose you could say. People look back on it and say that he didn't exasperate it. He didn't make it worse. He did put in place some reforms.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.